Hello, my name is Michael Rodriguez. I'm a librarian at Michigan State University. Today is September 13th, 2002. We're here to speak with Charlie Baxter. Charlie Baxter is the author most recently of a novel, The Feast of Love, on Vintage, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. He has published two other novels, First Light and Shadow Play, and four other books of stories, most recently Believers, published by Vintage. He has published essays on fiction collected in Burning Down the House and has edited or co-edited two books of essays, The Business of Memory, published by Grey Wolf, and Bringing the Devil to His Knees, the University of Michigan Press. He has also edited The Best New Voices, 2001, Harcourt. He has received the award in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He was born in Minneapolis in 1947, graduated from McAllister with a BA degree in 1969, and the State University of Buffalo, State University of New York at Buffalo with a PhD in 1974. He now lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and is adjunct professor of English at University of Michigan, stepping down from previously you were the director of the Creative Writing Program, right? Yeah. His work has been widely anthologized and has been translated into 10 languages. Welcome to the Michigan Writers Series.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Your novels strike me, this is the Michigan Writers Series. You know, the novels, the fiction especially, strikes one as being especially Michigan in origin, although you were born in Minnesota. I wanted to talk a little bit about that. Your most recent and I think your most successful novel is something set in, I think it's actually even called Ann Arbor. It's not veiled whatsoever, is it?
Yeah. It's Ann Arbor.
Right, it's Ann Arbor. I wonder how important the landscape of Michigan is towards a creation of something like a universe that you may be creating for the fictional world.
Well, I think when you write fiction, you're always thinking of what the landscape looks like. I imagine that poets, when they sit down, or actually when I was a poet, when I was writing poetry, I could sit down and start writing without thinking very much of what the setting was. But fiction writers need settings. And when they daydream, they usually have to daydream their work into existence based on what it is they're most familiar with and the sorts of rocks and stones and trees that they live with every day. And for me, for years it was Minnesota and then it was Michigan. Michigan is where I live, and when I close my eyes most of the time and think about where my characters are, it's in this state.
Mm-hmm. Do you think people that read your novels, do you think it helps to understand better a piece of fiction if they know that territory, if they know that landscape, if they know those kinds of people?
Well, I think if you know the landscape, you have a feeling sometimes of having run up against somebody, say, who's a relative in your family. Mm-hmm. I've had people write to me after reading The Feast of Love and say, oh, the Michigan Stadium, I've been there. Or Allmendinger Park, I know what that is. Or the water tower in Ypsilanti, yeah, I know what that looks mm-hmm. like. So it helps, but I don't think it's necessary.
Yeah.
At least I don't think it's necessary, and the reason I say that is that of all of my books, this is the one that's been translated the most.
Mm-hmm.
And to my great surprise, really, it's turned into a bestseller in Spain.
Okay.
And these are people who can't have any idea of mm-hmm. what Ann Arbor or Michigan look like and are just creating it out of what it is that I've said about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm very pleased by that. So I think, what do I think? I think it's a plus if you've been there, but if you haven't been there, mm-hmm. with any luck, the story will work on its own.
Well, not to belabor the point, but what do you think it is then that a reader in Madrid would like so much about the characters or the setting of something like The Feast of Love?
Well, what I think in part it is, if you're a reader in Madrid and I give you a novel that's set in New York, you think, oh, even if you haven't been there, mm-hmm. I've seen some Woody Allen movies, been to other movies that have New York as a setting, I know, I have some idea of maybe what New Yorkers are. Or if it's set in LA, everybody knows or thinks he or she knows what that landscape looks like. The South, Faulkner did it.
Yeah.
Welty did it. But Michigan, well, there's Jim Harrison, and Harrison's work is read a lot overseas. But for the most part, it's a section of the United States that people don't know. So if a reader in Madrid opens my book and begins reading, he or she might think, huh, I don't know very much about this mm-hmm. part of the world. Mm-hmm. What's it like? Mm-hmm. Well, that's maybe what my book will do.
So it's part curiosity.
Yeah, I think so.
Or something.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Something like that. It's like that part of the map that's blank mm-hmm. for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. It's another world.
Yeah.
Do you think that metaphysics is something that runs through this book, through Feast of Love, and in this grand sort of fashion? Do you think the metaphysics of someplace like Michigan or Ann Arbor is particular to its region? It's something that I've thought about often, thinking about great writers.
That's a terrific question, and nobody has ever asked me that question, and I would have to say that I can't come up with a glib answer for it. There is a philosopher in the book named Harry Ginsberg, and he's working on a project having to do with Kierkegaard and Wittgenstein, and he's trying to think through the problem of how you think about the unknowable. And I'd like to think that that's a Midwestern problem.
Or the unspeakable. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And so I think that makes its way into the book, but whether that's a specifically Midwestern problem, I think it would be provincial to say that. Kierkegaard was Danish, Wittgenstein was Austrian.
Yeah.
You know, you find your problems where you can.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of, I mean, all the characters, well, especially Harry
yeah.
and Chloe.
Yeah.
Chloe.
Thank you. You gave it the right pronunciation.
Yeah. They have this very developed sense of metaphysics.
Yeah.
And they're completely different in many respects.
Well, Chloe has gotten her sense of metaphysics mostly from the drugs that she's taken.
Yeah.
I mean, that gives you a sense of metaphysics, too. It may not be a philosopher's sense of metaphysics, but it comes from somewhere. She likes to think that she thinks about higher things, which, of course, she does
mm-hmm.
whenever she gets high.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the pop culture sense of the occult and everything that goes with that as well.
Right.
And I eventually wonder if there's a connection between the landscape of the Midwest and the way people think about metaphysics. And I think this is actually a good book that begins to explore that.
Well, suppose you were to say that in the West Coast, or on the West Coast, you mm-hmm. have mountains, you have mm-hmm. deserts, you
exactly.
have the ocean. On the East Coast, you have the ocean, you have the great cities, you have urban metropolises. In the Midwest, what you have is a landscape that seems very undistinguished
mm-hmm.
in some ways. There's farmland, a few hills, a few
mm-hmm.
trees, and that's about it. And what it does, the effect that it has on my characters, is that it makes them think about what else must be out there,
mm-hmm.
because this can't
mm-hmm.
be all there is.
Mm-hmm.
It really leaves the characters in a condition of needing compensation, needing something else because the landscape is so humble.
Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of introspection, or maybe it is.
It's good for writers.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful area for writers. I'm from Minnesota, and there are plaques for Sinclair Lewis, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Robert Bly was around when I grew up, James Wright was around when I grew up, the Midwest can boast Willa Cather, Wright Morris, a lot of wonderful writers. Mm-hmm. It may be that you're pushed into imaginative work living here in a way that you might not be if you live somewhere else.
Well, the sky is literally gray for
there is
the
that.
Winter.
There is that.
We don't look at the heavens in the same way that perhaps other cultures do.
No.
I think it's because of the success of Feast of Love that you've stepped down from your teaching position and become adjunct at University of Michigan. Is that, I guess the more general question is, has the success of the book changed your writing career?
Well, it hasn't. What I did was I went from being a full-time writer to an adjunct, and I thought that I would be able to get by with all of the things you need, such as health insurance and all of the other comps that go with teaching. And the truth was, in fact, that I couldn't. And so either I would have had to go back to full-time teaching or move. And my wife and I decided that we would move, and we're moving back to Minnesota this winter. And I'm going to be teaching half-time at the University of Minnesota starting next fall. I think I would like to be a full-time writer like Jim Harrison or Elmore Leonard, but I've been teaching for something like 30 years now, and I don't know, I'm used to it. It's also something that I think I do fairly well, and I also think that it's a good thing for writers to get out of the house now and then, and to get out of the habits of introspection that they get into. So I'm just as happy doing it as not.
You may not have as great access to people like Chloe if you didn't get out of the house, as you say, or teach or do something like that.
Well, Willa Cather says somewhere, I can't remember where, that if you live through your adolescence, you have all of the experience that you need to write from then on. But I do like getting out into the world, such as it is, that you meet up with on a university campus. And I don't think that I could spend the rest of my days in a study just writing. I don't think I could do it.
Yeah, you gotta do something.
Yeah.
There's two more questions I wanted to ask you, and one's sort of a riddle, so I'll save that for the last, and John's gonna start screaming at me any second. But first of all, that you write from the perspective of women in what I think is a commanding sort of fashion, I wonder if what women say to you about writing from the woman's perspective?
Mostly they like it. When the book came out, there were a few people, and actually you can find them in the Amazon.com website for this book, who felt that I got Chloe's voice wrong. And I knew there were going to be some people who would say that. I knew it when I started out with that character, that there were going to be some people who felt that I got her idiom wrong. But my feeling about it is that if you're a novelist and you live long enough, you don't get tired of your own gender, but you want to do other things. You want to do old people, you want to do young people, you want to do men and women. Playwrights have always done this sort of thing. If you're a male playwright, you have to take on the assumption that you can put words into the mouth of a woman. And that's all, really, that's all I did in this book. I don't think it's such a great leap. I do think that sometimes feminism has made some men feel that they can't imagine what women think. Mm-hmm. But of course they can imagine what women think. If they can't, and if women can't imagine what men think, then there's no possibility of communication. Mm-hmm. So I just went ahead and did it.
Mm-hmm. There's a fine line between, well, one of the ways in which the novel gets written is the characters, well, that is the way the novel gets written, is the characters talk to you,
right.
Basically.
Right, me.
So there's a fine line between speaking from a character's perspective and actually, there's a fine line between natural speech and the monologues they give.
Right. The trick in the book, and what made it difficult, is not only that these women are speaking, mm-hmm. it's that they're bearing their hearts.
Right.
They're telling you things that
right.
usually they would tell only to a really close friend. And, mm-hmm. and I thought it was really the technical problem of the book was not so much that I had women talking, but that I had both men and women telling these intimate mm-hmm. stories about themselves. If anything, I thought it was more difficult to get men to say those things than women.
Well, you found a good character with, what's the main character's name?
Bradley.
Bradley, yes. He's the perfect temperament to bear his soul, as it were, in a constant sort of fashion. We have to go, but one last question, which, especially when I was through reading the book, the device, the narrative device of the novel is that people tell their stories through you. And there's a sort of motif that runs through this as well, which is that of a voyeur, and who actually appears in a sort of disgusting fashion in one of the scenes between Chloe and her husband or her fiancé at the time, and this scuzzy character. What is the difference between a novelist and a voyeur?
I am so glad you asked that question. That is the first time anybody has noticed that mm-hmm. about this book. If you're sitting there listening to somebody talk about his or her love life, of course you're put into mm-hmm. the position of a voyeur.
And we are as readers, too.
You bet. Mm-hmm. There's always a kind of voyeurism implicit in reading or going to the movies. It's a sort of rear window situation mm-hmm. in Hitchcock's movie. And I thought that since there were so many instances of people listening to other people talk about their love lives, that I would really put voyeurism right into the book. I'd have this scuzzy character who pays money to see people mm-hmm. having sex. Now, it's true that a person like that is very, very, very different from someone who buys a book in order to read about other people's love lives, but it's not that mm-hmm. different. And that was a very difficult part of the book to write, but I thought that when I got to that section, the reader would start to feel a little uneasy about the position that he or she had been put in or had placed him or herself in reading this book, mm-hmm. watching the love lives of all of these people. The book has been out for something like 2 years, and you are the first person
That's
to
amazing.
Have noticed that.
I mean, pornography is something that runs through a lot of that story between
Absolutely.
Chloe and...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's there in headlines. I thought everybody would notice it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Charlie character is wandering around. He's all but looking in people's windows.
Mm. It must be my Midwestern heritage.
Must be.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate you coming.
My pleasure.
Yeah.